The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 190.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome two gentlemen to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. I cannot wait for this conversation. These two gentlemen really need no introduction, but it's David Stockman and Doug Casey. Gentlemen, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show. David, if you could go through your backstory briefly, get us up to speed there, and then we'll start off with the conversation.
Well, I guess the essence of it is I never held a steady job. I started working on Capitol Hill when I was 22 as a legislative assistant. Got elected to Congress when I was 30 in 1976. Became part of the kind of rebel gang in the Republican Party that got behind Jack Kemp. We got Ronald Reagan nominated for president. I became the budget director. We tried to launch the Reagan Revolution. Made a little headway, not much. I finally gave up when the deficit got just totally out of control and Republicans showed their true color. They were interested in giving speeches against big government, but not actually walking the plank when it came to tough votes to roll back the welfare state. And, you know, defense spending got totally out of control. It became impossible. I went to Wall Street for the next 20 years. And, you know, now I'm in the business of, commentating on what I've learned over 50 years about the way the world works and some of the big, problems and challenges that we're facing today.
Yeah, so let's dive right into the economic stuff. For Doug, I've heard you talk for many years that we're kind of in the eye of this tornado, eye of the storm. And when we come out the other side, it's going to be far worse than the GFC. I mean, we've seen that playing out in 2020. But in your opinion, where are we now from an economic standpoint? What do you think 2021 is going to look like now that we've got the Biden administration and the market kind of shrugging off $1.9 trillion stimulus packages?
Well, it's the eye of the hurricane, actually. But we're no longer in the eye. I think we're going into the trailing edge now. And bringing things completely up to date, I'd say that what happened on January 6th, which was essentially a big nothing, but it's being blown out of all proportion by the new occupants of the government, I think it amounted to a Reichstag fire. As far as we're headed towards a police state politically, and we're headed towards a real explosion sociologically, it could turn into something like a civil war. As far as the stock market's concerned, I guess it's okay as long as they keep printing up money, because most of it is going to go into financial assets. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
What do you think? You know, I've done a couple videos recently talking about the crack-up boom, or what Mises referred to as the crack-up boom. And if you read just a short paragraph, a short summary, it's exactly what's happening today. But, and that may be great for the stock market, but what does that do to social unrest? Because I don't know if you know Chris Cole, but he's one of my favorites, and he has a theory that if you can't destroy volatility, you can only transfer it. So if you try to move volatility away from the stock market, it's going to show up in social unrest. What do you think about that?
Oh, I agree completely. And it does look like we're on the edge of a crack-up, which I might describe as being economic activity. Basically, what happened in Germany in the early 20s, where people are panicking to get out of currency and get into real goods. Now, whether those real goods are productive or not is a different question. In fact, most of them are not going to be productive because in the kind of highly regulated society we have today, trying to do business is almost a fool's errand. So we're all being driven to being speculators as opposed to producers. So yeah, we're entering that stage. It's going to be wild and crazy and not pleasant.
Yeah, you know, you say that we're all driven to be speculators, and it reminds me of all these, I don't know if you know what TikTok is, or it's just basically kind of this social platform with these short videos. A lot of kids are on it right now, but I get tweeted so many of these TikTok videos of people talking about how much money they've made in the stock market. And these are like, you know, 16-year-old kids saying that you should take your stimmy check and go out and buy Tesla or buy XYZ stock that has gone up the most in 6 months with your Robinhood account. And it just shows you that the government, the Fed, is just really pushing people not into saving, not into investing, not into hard work, but incentivizing more of a gambling mentality. Dave, I know I just watched a video of yours where you're talking about these stimulus programs. And I just was watching Janet Yellen yesterday saying that we need to, quote unquote, act big.
Big.
Which obviously in a central bank speak means we just need to spend a ton of money here and that's going to fix all the problems. So what was your take on, what's your take on Janet Yellen being the Treasury Secretary? And then what do you think about what she was talking about yesterday?
Yeah, I'll answer that, but points we've covered. There's one going around of some kid saying, it's very easy. I get out my screen. I find a stock that's going up. I buy it and I keep buying more till it stops going up and then I sell it. Now, isn't that simple? I mean, that's all it takes. And, you know, they're using their stimmy checks in mom and pop's basement on their Robinhood platform. So, I mean, we are really off the deep end. You talk about a crack-up boom. I would say, you know, we're at the tippy top of that. Biden is being inaugurated, the most left-wing anti-capitalist government in history that stumbled into office on 44,000 votes in three states out of 165 million cast. And nevertheless, the stock market today, you know, is at 3850 on the S&P 500, which is 41 times actual 2020 GAAP earnings, the kind you report to the SEC and you don't go to jail for if you report them. But even if you look at so-called X items, you know, the Wall Street, they strip out any bad stuff. This is crazy, but they say, well, don't worry. 2020 didn't count. It was a huge disaster with COVID, the lockdowns, and so forth. Just skip on by that. Earnings are going to rise by 60% by the end of 2021. Now, how they are so confident about that, I have no idea. And so, therefore, the market's reasonable because it's only trading at about 25 to 30 times. I mean, the whole thing is in the land of a complete ludicrous a financial disconnect from the real world. Now, we have Yellen coming in yesterday saying, go big. I've done some analysis of, you know, what Biden's proposed with his $1.9 trillion, COVID relief bill. That's the fifth one since late March. If you put them all together, it adds up, you know, the Families First Act and the CARES Act and the ones in between. It adds up to $6 trillion. So I said, $6 trillion at the GDP, that's practically a third of GDP. How big is the hole in terms of lost wages or lost GDP or lost business value added over the course of the 9 months or 10 months since all this started? Well, it turns out lost wages, if we look at February as the pre-COVID so-called, greatest economy in the world, wage and salary disbursements in the U.S. economy were about $800 billion a month. Okay, if you say that was pretty good, at least everybody thought so at the time, and that is the benchmark for the next 10 months, we've actually had a $300 billion shortfall over those 10 months from the February benchmark level. Now, $300 billion shortfall in wage and salaries against $6 trillion of, bailouts and relief going into the economy, you know, they've overdone it 22 times, okay? And if you then even take out some of the business and medical aid and so forth, just the amount of money going for unemployment insurance and transfer payments and helicopter checks and directly to households is almost $2 trillion. And again, compare that to this $300 billion loss of wages. In other words, they're totally off the deep end. Everybody has heard this before. The numbers, though, are now just startling. And it's all because the Fed is printing enough new balance sheet to fund every single dime of this massive spending and borrowing spree. And that's what they've done. You know, they've printed $3.6 trillion in the last 14, 15 months. So I think, you know, we're working our way to the edge of sanity, if not beyond. This really, who knows how long it can continue. We're in some uncharted waters that have never even been contemplated by the most radical populist economists in history. But surely free lunches are at the heart of it. And sooner or later, you know, a free lunch economy is going to implode on its own, you know, its own weaknesses.
Yeah, Doug, let's touch on that momentarily. And Dave, I'd like to get your thoughts on this as well. When I was listening to Janet yesterday, Janet Yellen, or whatever, I don't want to be disrespectful, but whatever her name is, Yellen, I'm not sure what the title is. But she's talking about this Act Big, but she set up kind of a cost-benefit analysis, at least when she was getting some pushback there. And she just said that the benefit of these huge stimulus packages, it outweighs the cost. But the only thing that she referenced in terms of the cost was just the added debt to the balance sheet of the federal government. But when I look at government spending, I look at the cost as a further distortion of the economy, a reduction of free market capitalism. You have a misallocation of resources and a ton of malinvestment. So my question, because you guys have so much more experience than I do, is how can these economists, or how can Janet Yellen, just focus on the balance sheet of the federal government as if there is no other cost to just limitless spending by the government?
Well, first of all, I point out that Janet Yellen is not an economist. An economist is somebody that describes the way the world works. But that's not what she's doing. She's prescribing the way she thinks the world ought to work, right, and is having her views enforced by the political powers. And the bottom line of all of this money creation, is that it's centering more attention and more power towards the government. That's very unfortunate, because the government is pure coercion. There's nothing voluntary about it. It's corrupting the entire society, and it's actually going to wind up destroying the economy, much the way Germany's money printing destroyed its economy in the 20s, or Zimbabwe's a few years ago, or Venezuela's today. It's going to have the same result. But because the U.S. is so large and so powerful, it's going to take a little bit more time. And all that money to kiss the economy and make it better, it's all going into the hands of the rich guys, frankly. The little people get some table scraps that fall off the plate, but the huge majority of that money is going to corporations and banks and things of that nature. So the rich are, in fact, getting richer, and the poor are getting actually poorer. So this is going to end very, very badly. And it's not just an economic disaster we're looking at. It's not just a financial disaster. It's much more serious than that.
Yeah. In the future, I just try to think through kind of the knock-on effects of government becoming bigger and bigger and power becoming more centralized. Are you someone that believes there's an inverse correlation between the size of government or government power and the morals of the people who try to get elected to be in those positions of power? In other words, if the size of government is growing, the morals or ethics of the politicians is shrinking.
Well, you're quite correct. Look, there are basically two types of people in the world. People that like to deal with physical reality and make things out of wood and plaster and metal and things like that, control the physical universe. And then there are people that just like to control other people. And those are the kind that wind up in Washington, D.C. And the more resources, other people's money, in other words, that get into their hands, the more crazy they get. Right. So, and at this point, there's really no alternative for them to printing up more money. If they stop printing up money, the whole rotten structure is going to collapse. Banks are going to fail. Insurance companies are going to fail. Hedge funds will go bankrupt. Pension funds will go bankrupt. There'll be lots of unemployment as the system unwinds. Mm-hmm. Now, all the real wealth in the world would still be there. Well, most of the real wealth in the world would still be there. But it would be a really nasty time, and everybody would blame the government. It is their fault, in effect. But they have to print more money. So, yes, they're going to print lots more, and the situation is going to get much worse.
Yeah, David, I'd like to get your take on that, because I go back and forth with people on the show, really, really smart people, far smarter than I am. But it seems as though the deflationist argument is, if things stay as they are, and if we allowed the free market to work, we would definitely see massive deflation, especially in assets. But then the inflationist side of that, or the inflationist people maybe say, okay, well, we get that if the system stayed as is, and if the Federal Reserve obeyed or acknowledged the Federal Reserve Act, and if that was a constraint on the Federal Reserve, then yes, we would see price deflation, at least in assets. But we think that they're going to completely ignore it. Look at what they did in March. And at some point in the near future, we think that, as Dr. Lacey Hunt says, that we're going to start turning bank reserves that the Fed can print into legal tender. And that's MMT, where you're combining the balance sheet of the Fed and the Treasury. And because we believe the system is going to change, to Doug's point, that's why we believe that the inflationary effect of all this money printing getting into the real economy is going to overwhelm the deflationary effects we should have in a free market. How do you see that?
Well, I don't know where it's going to go, but in the last 10 years, but really 30 years, the massive balance sheet expansion at the Fed, as well as all the other central banks of the world, which are just copycats and basically are racing the Fed to the bottom, that's basically gone into two things. One, the inflation of financial assets. I noted yesterday in something I wrote that household holdings of stock, both stock and mutual funds, went from $2 trillion in 1989 to about $31 trillion at present. Okay, that's a 16x, 15x gain. GDP during that period went from about $6 trillion to $21 trillion, or about 3.5 times. Well, that isn't normal. That isn't sustainable. You can't say that the value of stock or related financial assets has risen 16, 17 times over that 30-year period, when the underlying economy and the income and the output that it represents has expanded at only a fraction of that. So I think we have a tremendous asset inflation, and it will deflate if the Fed or the other central banks stop buying the bond. And at some point, I think they're going to have to stop. Even sanity will break through in those, behind closed doors in the Eccles building. And if the central banks ever falter or begin to try to taper or stop the madness that they have underway now, $120 billion a month, at the Fed, $250 billion a month if you count the Fed and the ECB, and $500 billion if you take all the banks in the world. The minute that slows down, I think the whole financial asset bubble is going to blow sky high, and there'll be a huge day of reckoning. It's only a matter of time before the central banks run out of craziness, run out of nerve, run out of the kind of insanity that's driving the groupthink today.
Well, I got two questions there. What would you say to people who push back regarding asset prices being fair valued because interest rates are so low? And then number two, what would stop the Fed? I mean, what they're not going to go to church one day and say, oh my gosh, I've been doing this all wrong. What prevent? Do we get inflation that where they paint themselves into a corner where they can't print any more money, or because it exacerbates inflation, they can't raise interest rates because the debt's so big? Or, I mean, what calls their bluff?
Well, on the first one, it puts you in mind of the 12-year-old kid who killed both of his parents and then threw himself on the mercy of the courts on the ground that he was an orphan. Okay, so the Fed today has killed the bond market. It's killed the bond yield. The bond yields are absurd. There's $18 trillion of, you know, negative yielding debt in the world, and even, you know, the U.S. Treasury, the benchmark at 1% today is crazy. So as a result of killing the bond yield, PE multiples have expanded. But obviously, you're going to keep the bond yield at 1% forever. That can't continue. So I think that argument is nonsense. It's a non sequitur. In terms of why, I just don't see the inflation argument that suddenly all of this is going to go into spending for goods and services. I mean, when the bubble starts to collapse, it collapses. Collapses on itself. I mean, the bond out there, there's 90 trillion of bonds in the world. There's a good short share of them owned on repo by Wall Street traders and investors and arbitrageurs. And when they finally have to unwind their repo and sell the bonds, the price of those bonds is going to go down, but it's not going to put any cash in someone's pocket to go out and buy some more cars or, you know, other goods and services. I think this thing is inflated financially, and it's going to deflate financially, and I don't think it's going to spill over into 1920s, Weimar Republic or Zimbabwe or any of the rest. It's going to be a massive deflation in Wall Street. How that plays out in the real economy is really hard to know. It won't be good, that's for sure. But I think this is a Wall Street financially centered deflation, not a Main Street hyperinflation.
Doug, do you think we could get something like the 1970s? And I was I was born in 73, so I don't recall it too much. But I think you guys were right there front and center. And it, just by looking at the statistics, I know that we had severe consumer price inflation. But from 72 to 74, I believe the stock market went down by 50% in nominal terms. So do you see a situation for the United States going into 2021 where we could see or start to see a similar process where we just cannot prop up these asset bubbles anymore? They start to deflate in nominal terms, but at the same time, consumer price inflation, the stuff that people buy at the grocery store every day, they're going up at, let's say, 7, 10% per year.
Well, I really can't predict where interest rates are going. I could tell you a joke if we wanted to take 2 minutes to hear a funny joke about interest rates, but
yeah.
Okay, this will be fun. So Einstein dies and goes to heaven. He's greeted by Saint Peter. Saint Peter says, "Welcome." Unfortunately, we have a temporary housing shortage because, for obvious reasons, we're a centrally planned economy here in heaven. But Einstein goes to his new room, meets his three new roommates. First guy comes up, says, "Mr. Einstein, I have an IQ of 130, and I'd like to get to know you better." So Einstein says, "Well, let me put my, after lunch, let's bounce around some ideas on astrophysics that I've been thinking recently. Second guy comes up to him and says, Mr. Einstein, I'm not as smart as that first guy. I've only got an IQ of 100, but I still want to get to know you. So Einstein says, well, let me put my grip away and let's play a game of chess. Third guy comes up, says, I'm not as smart as the other two guys, but I'd like to get to know you. I've only got an IQ of 70. So Einstein says, so where do you think interest rates are going? Well, you know, with that preamble, I'll say that eventually interest rates are going to go a lot higher, because the only way you can get rich is by savings, and low interest rates, artificially low interest rates, where they're below the level of inflation, discourage people from saving. So real capital isn't accumulated. Sure, they're going to go much, much higher in the future. I don't know what's going to happen to the stock market. I can build a bear case and a bull case for it.
Right.
All I can really predict is financial chaos. You know, one thing that I don't hear discussed very often is the fact that the major export of the U.S. since the 1980s it has not been Boeings or IBMs or wheat or things like that. It's been dollars.
Right.
We've sent trillions of dollars abroad, and those nice foreigners have accepted them. And in exchange, given us Mercedes and Sonys and cocaine and other good stuff. But at some point, since they don't have to trade in dollars, they're not going to keep taking them. And they're all going to come back to the U.S. to buy stuff here. Mm-hmm. And although I'm talking to you right now from Uruguay, I'm referring to here in the U.S. So all of the wealth of the U.S. is going to be packed up and exported or owned by non-Americans who are going to be impoverished. And all those dollars with less wealth are going to result in much higher levels of inflation. So I think that's going to happen, but who knows? We're in terra incognita. We're dealing with crazy people in Washington.
Yeah. So, Doug, on that note, and earlier you talked about the extreme regulations that you're now seeing in the United States compared to, you know, the 1970s, the 1980s. I would suggest even the 1990s as far as the business environment. And a lot of people say, well, okay, if that happens, Doug, then the prices of foreign goods goes much, much higher. Americans can't afford to buy the goods from China or elsewhere. So that's good because then we'll start making stuff here in the United States. My pushback to that is, well, that's great in theory and that would be nice. But unfortunately now with the taxes, with the regulation, you're not going to find too many people who want to spend $1 billion to set up a factory that they cannot move in California, as an example. So what are your thoughts on that? And what do you think the average American is missing there when they say, well, let's just make everything in the United States?
Well, you're absolutely correct, the way you stated it, George. But look, we're looking at a depression, which the best broad general definition is it's a period of time when most people's standard of living drops significantly. Right. And are we going to set up all kinds of factories to build stuff in the U.S.? Well, I mean, maybe the whole nature of manufacturing is going to change. That's possible with on-demand 3D printing, things of that nature, the development of nanotechnology, so forth. I mean, we can't underrate technological changes, which are happening in many areas, robotics, space exploration, artificial intelligence, and that's holding up the standard of living. But it's basically at this point just helping the rich people. So what's going to happen? I think the average American is going to be left with an empty bag of money, his $2,000 a month, which will probably become something like a guaranteed annual income, an incredibly stupid idea, but it's on the way with these people in office. I don't know, George. Like I said, we're sailing in genuinely uncharted waters. It's one thing when this kind of thing happens to nothing, nowhere places like Venezuela or Zimbabwe, it's something else when it happens to the most powerful country in the world with a gigantic military whose dollars are the major asset of most of the central banks in the world. Mm. I mean, they're really playing with fire, I think.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So we're talking about kind of the future. We're talking about technology. Do you have any opinion on a central bank digital currency? Because I started talking about that in 2019. And, you know, everyone was telling me that I was wearing a tinfoil hat and that's crazy talk. But now, if you listen to the IMF, you know, Jerome Powell has talked about it. We see China rolling out their central bank digital currency. Have you given that much thought? And if so, how do you see that affecting the economy and the average American in the future?
Well, I mean, the central banks will try to do anything to maintain their control and their management efficacy over the financial system, to the extent that, digital currencies are just an alternative payments processing technology. I could, since the central banks process all the payments in the world anyway, you know, I can see that rather easily happening. I think that will only just exacerbate the problem, make it even easier for the central banks to wreck the system. But I don't see it as anything necessarily sinister or nefarious. I just think it's an evolution that's underway. The problem is central banking. The problem is the Keynesian notion that the economy of the world is always short of demand, and that central banks the job of the central banks is to inject enough demand to fill up the bathtubs, you know, the economic bathtub of the world and the country to the brim, so that everybody will live happily ever after. This is just damn nonsense. Economies grow on the supply side. They grow from entrepreneurs. They grow from savings, innovation, investment, technological advance. None of this can come out of a central bank. It's just the wrong way. It's the wrong track. It's the wrong theory of how the world works. And until somehow we understand that the central banks are the number one, number two, and number three problem of the world, I don't think the direction is going to change.
If you could just wave a magic wand and we could go into a society that was much, much better as far as from a banking standpoint, what would that look like to you? And Doug, maybe I'll ask the same question. Would that be full reserve banking? Would that be free banking that we saw in the early 1800s, where the government and there is no central bank, but the government really isn't involved whatsoever, and banks are issuing their own IOUs, their own currency? Or what do you think would be the optimal approach if we could just start from scratch?
I don't think you have to go radical. I think you can just go to 1913 Carter Glass his idea of the Fed, that it was a banker's bank. It had no open market committee. It had no mandate for X, level of inflation or Y level of unemployment or G level of housing starts. None of that mattered. Its job was simply to supply reserves to the system at a penalty rate above the free market level of interest on the presentation of good collateral, which excluded government debt. Now, that was very simple. That was a passive central bank, and it allowed the key thing that capitalism needs to thrive, and that is that pricing of all financial assets happened in the market, not at the open market committee of 12 right. geniuses at the Fed. And that's what we need now. Get the Fed, if you abolish the open market committee and you prevented them from buying one more dime of government or quasi-government debt, I think you would be a long way down the road to beginning to rectify the system. You would have to go through a pretty traumatic adjustment in the financial markets as interest rates rose, PE multiples fell, stock gamblers lost their shirts, but sooner or later you're going to have to go through it. But I think it's not free banking necessarily or abolishing the Fed necessarily. It's simply honest price discovery and free market setting of interest rates from the overnight money to 50-year money or 100-year money if somebody's going to issue that kind of debt, as well as all the derivative financial instruments from stocks, ETFs, real estate, and the rest. That's where you start. Let the market put the market back into the price discovery business, and we'll begin to rectify the system.
Yeah, so Doug, I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Assuming that you agree for the most part, what does it look like if, now, excuse me, going back to reality, for our economy to get from where we are today to what Doug was just talking about? Would that just be some severe, severe pain for 2-3 years, then we come out the other end with all the malinvestment and misallocation of resources kind of washed out of the system, and then we kind of start from scratch? Or what would it look like to you? I mean, is it even possible? Do we have the political willpower, or the society, do they have the willpower to do what it takes to get us to that point?
Yeah, listen, I agree with just about everything that David says. I mean, I read his newsletter every day, which is excellent, incidentally. So I agree with all that, but I think that we're in too deep at this point for half measures. For instance, the Federal Reserve, if it went back to the way it was at its founding in 1913, okay, you could live with that, but we're never going back there, because if they because if they stop printing money, the whole system is going to collapse with the consequences that I described earlier. And the thing is that the American public has been so indoctrinated over many decades by being processed in government schools, where they've learned all kinds of phony economics and phony history.
Right.
They won't put up with it. They think that the government is the cornucopia. So that I think this is all going to have to be washed away somehow, and it'll be most unpleasant, because if we have something like a real revolution in this country, which it's building up to with 75 million deplorables that hate the other, well, you know, the red people and the blue people actually hate each other at this point, and you can't have under one political umbrella, especially an extremely powerful political umbrella that allocates goods and services, does a lot more than just protect people from crime and allow them to run court disputes peacefully. The government does everything but those things, which it doesn't do very well. No, we're looking at an explosion. And the problem is, after an explosion, it gets worse. Just like after 1789 in France, right to have gotten rid of the government of Louis XVI, but it got worse with Robespierre and Napoleon. Same thing happened right to get rid of Nicholas II in Russia in 1917. But then it got a lot worse with Lenin and worse again with Stalin. And I can give you other examples of that. So, yeah, I wish that we could kind of wind this thing down. I don't see how that's possible. I think we're heading for a smash up, and we'll just have to see where the pieces wind up, among other things. There's no guarantee that there's no stability to the map on the wall. I mean, the colors of maps on the wall have been running for thousands of years.
Right.
I see the U.S. as a multicultural domestic empire at this point. I think it's going to fall apart. I'm not saying tomorrow morning, but over the next couple of generations.
Yeah, I don't want to go out too far off topic, but I would be really curious to get your opinion. I was reading a stat the other day, Doug, and this goes back to kind of the civil unrest and the kind of intestinal fortitude that we would need to have as Americans to say, okay, we need to take the pain because we need to get all of this. This system is unsustainable. So we need to go through some bad years to get out the other side and to be better. But that is just, I don't know, from a society standpoint, it just seems so hard for them to make that decision.
That's what's necessary. But the American people won't take it. And as a matter of fact, before that happens, we're going to have what amounts to a social credit system in this country. I mean, this country is starting to imitate the Chinese, talk about ridiculous things, where everybody's afraid to do anything wrong or say anything wrong or think anything wrong because it'll ding their social credit score. And maybe they can't get on a plane or God knows what. So that's the direction it's going. So, yeah, you're right. We should have kind of a time of reckoning where things get straightened out with.
I think we may get to Armageddon, but there is a sliver of hope on an alternative that actually arises from the silver lining that we see in the smash up of the two parties today. I think if they go forward in the Senate trying to impeach Trump after he's out of office, which he is now, it will lead to the breakup of the Republican Party. And I devoutly hope that will happen, because it at least offers an avenue for some of the sensible leaders in the libertarian section, which is small, of the Republican Party, to move in an independent direction and attempt to re-aggregate a new party. I'm talking about someone like Rand Paul, who understands the four essentials that I believe you could create a new coalition around. Number one, the American empire has to end. He understands that. I think there is a huge peace wing element in the country that has no voice, no home at the present. The Democrats have become the war party, that becomes plank number one. Dismantle the empire, dismantle $750, $800 billion defense budget, use it at home, use it to pay the debt. That's the peace wing. The second thing is, an attack on the Fed as an attack on Wall Street. I mean, no one understands what the Fed's about, monetary policy and how rapidly the balance sheet's growing and so forth. But they do understand that when, a handful of billionaires pick up $3-4 trillion worth of net worth during a disastrous year like 2020, when 70 million people have filed for unemployment benefits, something's wrong. So, attack the Fed and attack the consequences of what it does. Number three, attack civil liberties. I mean, stand up for civil liberties, because Dr. Fauci and the virus patrol is going to, they're going to get a new lease on life with the Biden people, who are even crazier than Trump's corona task force. And there are tens of millions of people out there in the country who are just fed up with being told to stay home, and watch Netflix and wait for us to give you a signal that you can stick your head out the front door. And Rand Paul is on that. And I think that's another realigning factor. going on in the country today. And then finally, people are fed up with politics. So we can see a fourth, dimension to this poll, which is a revival of federalism. Let's not do everything in Washington. Let the states handle it. And if California wants to go off the deep end, fine. And if people want to move to Texas, that's even better. But let's begin to unwind and shrink the monster in Washington and put the states and localities back into the business of government. I think those four platforms could become, political poles for realigning the system around a new party. And if you got that, maybe there's a hope over the next decade that you could unwind the fiscal Armageddon, the monetary mess, the massive financial bubbles, and begin to get a semblance of, capitalist prosperity and individual liberty and limited democratic governance reestablished. I think it's a long shot, a very long shot, but it's still not beyond the realm of the possibility. But it all depends on the crack up of the Republican Party and purging it of all these neocons, of all these Trumpite crazies, of all of these Washington hangers-on, for instance, McConnell's been on the public payroll for 57 years, and McCarthy, the Republican leader in the Senate, about 30. So they got 90 years on the public teat among them. What do they know about the real world? So let's purge the party of all those bad elements. Try to form a new party, and maybe there's a chance.
Yeah, and I think in order to do that, we have to change culture and the general attitude of the population to make that happen. At the end of the day, I think it has a lot to do with culture. And on that note, I know, Doug, you've traveled to almost every country out there. You've lived, I think, in 10 or 15 countries. And first and foremost, I want to get your take on the culture right now in the United States and maybe other places in the world where you see the culture maybe more leaning towards free market capitalism. And then I want to talk about what the average American can do to set up a plan B to kind of, if we do get some social unrest, to kind of ride it out and to just kind of sit back and watch what happens and then try to encourage and support the libertarian movement that David was referring to.
Well, I'm very, very sympathetic to everything David and you are saying, but I don't think it's going to happen. Here's a fun statistic, fun fact. Yeah. There's something called the Myers-Briggs test. Most people are aware of it now. And libertarians are overwhelmingly what they call INTJs, which only amount to about 2.5% of all the people. That's the relative population of libertarians in the U.S. About 2.5%. So we're not even a rounding error. And the average American has been so corrupted at this point, it's impossible to turn things around with an intellectual argument. And further speaking to that, it's what we've got is a cultural war going on, where we've got cultural conservatives against the people that want to overturn the whole nature of the U.S. And, frankly, college graduates and everybody that's gone through the public school system is philosophically numbered among the bad guys. So I don't think we can change things politically. I mean, the bad guys are just too thoroughly entrenched. So it's kind of become, I think the key phrase here is in French, sauve qui peut, he who can save themselves. So I've been buying gold and silver for a very long time, never sold any. Right now, I'm very heavily invested in gold mining stocks, which are the only part of the market, amazingly, which are actually very cheap.
Right.
Another fun fact, average all-in sustaining cost of a producing gold mine today, and some are much less, is $1,000 per ounce. Price of gold is about $1,830 or something like that. So they're actually making a lot of money. Eventually, the fund managers of any description are going to buy these things for the same reason that Buffett bought some recently, and he hates gold. And for good reasons, he doesn't believe in mining, but even he's done that. And he's smarter than the average bear. So that's what the average guy should do. But there's not much you can do politically, I don't think. You'll be deplatformed. Well, you might be deplatformed. So might I.
Yeah. So what I always tell people to do is, you know, at least have an RV or something that you can get out into the mountains if it hits the fan. If you live in an urban area, try to get a second passport, just internationalize, you know, get a bank account outside the United States. We talk about that. But going back to the discussion here, let's talk about investing, because you guys have a newsletter and you guys talk about these things, how people can, what I say, build wealth and thrive in a world of out of control central banks and big governments. That's kind of the tagline that I use on my videos. So I think gold is really interesting right now because there's so much attention on Bitcoin. And I, you know, I think that's a great speculation, but everyone's kind of forgot about gold. And you see M2 money supply going parabolic and the price of gold, you know, slightly going down. I understand that interest rates are going up and, you know, real rates affect the price of gold. But then, you know, you look at some of the miners, they could be cheap. Dave, what's your opinion on that? And guys, what other investment ideas are you mulling over? I'm a big fan of commodities right now. I'd love to get your take on that.
Well, I would defer to Doug on the miners and gold. I own gold myself for the same reasons. A few years ago, though, I had an investment slogan called the ABCD plan, which stood for anything Bernanke can't destroy. Is what you know, and you just put the Fed in there instead of ABCD. So anything that trades in the financial markets, bonds, stocks, ETFs, all kinds of options and derivatives. You know, all of those are creatures of central bank distortion and inflation. You know, if you stay in there for the last 4% or 8%, more power to you, but it's going to go down 60 or 70 or 80%. We got the biggest bond bubble in world history, the biggest stock bubble in world history. So that's the first rule. Secondly, what is it that central banks can't manipulate or destroy? Obviously, it's true for centuries, gold, and it still is. So I think that's where you put your investment. Third, I think we don't know how this is going to unfold politically or financially in terms of what central banks do, fiscal policy does, and so forth. So the main thing is to stay liquid, stay in cash, don't take any risks. At the present time, some people say, well, let's buy real estate. I suppose there's selective real estate in the world that might be a very good bargain at the moment. But I'm here in Aspen. It should be pretty safe, right? I bury some cash behind the house. But the point is, the real estate in Aspen is crazy because it's just a derivative of interest rates, you know, that have been pushed to the floorboard and below. And that's true of most real estate in the world, regardless of the so-called location issue. It's all been inflated because it's just the reciprocal of this ultra-low bond yield. So it's not a very appetizing outlook. I think it's, you know, a period in which you try to defend your accumulated wealth, in which you're ultra defensive, in which you're totally agnostic, if not atheistic, about, you know, the mainstream view of what's happening financially. And then we'll just have to see how it unfolds in these uncharted waters that we're actually in. There's nothing historically like this. I mean, I agree with Doug. We could go back to France in 1790, learn a little bit. We can go to Russia in 1917, learn a little bit. We can go to Roosevelt in the 1930s and learn a little bit more. But this is off the charts. We've got central banks in the world that are printing, you know, upwards of $1 billion a day. And just injecting it into the system. So, you know, the only thing you can do is understand history, try to keep a, you know, open mind about what's really happening as opposed to mainstream narrative. and sort of pick your way through the minefield. You know, that's really where we are. And it takes a lot more effort and a lot more focus than should be the case. I mean, people shouldn't have to be worried about all the big picture stuff we're talking about today. They should be living their lives. They should be running their businesses. They should be, you know, trying to, you know, achieve their dreams and invent the greatest mousetrap ever. But, you know, what's happening as a result of all this is that people are getting caught up in this, short run, day-to-day narrative that is almost the opposite of what we ought to really be, contending with.
Yeah, you know, I had a conversation with Jeff Snyder, one of the smartest guys I know, the other day. I said, Jeff, what would be a signal that would show you the economy is back on its feet? It's fundamentally sound again. He said, when no one knows the name of who's in charge at the Fed.
Yeah.
I thought yeah. that, if you think about that, that's...
Yeah, well, that's like ABCD, right? You don't. If they got out of the way, the world would be a lot better place, that's for sure. Yeah.
So Doug, I know you guys are short on time here. Finally, what do you think about commodities? I'd really love to get your take on this because I talk about it all the time. I loved them back in March. But now they've had a run, copper's had a run, oil's had a run. Do you think they're still cheap there, or you're a little hesitant, maybe long-term bullish, short-term a little agnostic, and then uranium? How are you looking at that space?
Yes, I've long been a big fan of uranium because nuclear power is in fact the safest, the cheapest, and the cleanest form of mass power generation. So I'm long stocks that are mining it, and that's for sure with uranium. And I've talked about gold stocks. And of course, then you got the other commodities, the meats and the grains and these things, and they've all been really moving. One of the problems with their getting higher, and I think they're going a lot higher, is the Arab Spring blew up because wheat prices were unsustainably high for poor people in the Middle East. So we could see that again. There's all kinds of consequences. So what do you do?
What do you think about coal?
Well, coal is absolutely in the toilet. And of course, oil's been down. I've got to be a bull on oil at this point, too. That's a whole different discussion. But yeah, I'm a bull on those things, quite frankly.
Okay.
Yeah. All of the commodities relative to the stock market, they're actually still at all-time lows, even though now many commodities which were selling below cost of production, which is the best benchmark of whether commodities are cheap
or dear. Uranium still trading under the cost of production for sure.
One reason why I really like it, right. But a lot of the other commodities, the farm commodities anyway, are now selling at above the cost of production. So, not as bullish, but it's really hard to take advantage of these. I mean, trading futures is a full-time job.
Right.
So I don't know what to tell the average guy to do about that. I guess just buy gold and silver. That's easy to do in cash form, yeah. And it's going to work out okay, even from present levels, which aren't cheap, incidentally.
But let me give you a quick question. Best performing stock in the entire stock market since 1968. What do you think?
Berkshire Hathaway?
Altria.
Altria, really?
So, and the best
sector was the year that was right after the Surgeon General said smoking's going to kill you. So that's kind of interesting, right?
Yeah, my point is, never be afraid to look into things that people hate. And right now, tobacco's got a great dividend. But anyway, so guys, tell me about the partnership deal that you have going on in this this newsletter. I'm really excited to tell my viewers and listeners about it.
Well, David does most of the heavy lifting, and I just add comments from the peanut gallery. and toss in some particular stock picks. So, but I think it's great because that publication that David and I have actually takes the best of what David writes in his daily letter,
right,
and in a very succinct form. So it's a good thing to subscribe, and the price is right. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, very reasonable price. And I've got an affiliate link your people sent over, so I'll put that in the link the link in the description below. And I think you guys have an offer running right now, promotion. So David, what types of things do you typically discuss when you're doing the heavy lifting for Doug?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it should be obvious from this conversation that both Doug and I are dyed-in-the-wool contrarians. I spend every day writing my own publication called David Stockman's Contra Corner. And, you know, we take on all the topics that are important. What's happening geopolitically, what's happening on Wall Street, Fed, Washington, the political crisis, all of these issues. And Doug works on these kinds of issues day to day as well. And so what we do is once a month, we kind of put our heads together, so to speak, in terms of the more salient topics that have come up during the course of the month. And we put that together in a monthly publication. And we hope it gives people some current insight on events that have just happened and where we may be going in the near-term future, both from a financial and political point of view, but as well what it might imply for your investments and your wealth.
Okay, sounds good, guys. Well, I sincerely appreciate your time, Doug. It's always awesome to talk to you. And David, first time we've had the opportunity to speak, but I can't wait to do it again. So thank you for your time, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.